From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Recently, a team of medical scientists led by Dr. Shukrat Mitalipov at the Oregon Health and Science University, or OHSU, successfully repaired a gene in a human embryo that is known to cause a common and potentially fatal genetic heart disease, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The American Heart Association says that this disease is a common cause of sudden cardiac arrest among young people, including young athletes. Correcting the defective gene not only keeps the individual from developing the disease, but also ensures that he or she would not be able to pass along this genetic defect to future generations. To perform the gene editing, Dr. Mitalipov's team used a tool called CRISPR-Cas9. It's a unique technology that helps scientists customize genes by allowing them to remove, add, or change sections within its DNA, which in itself contains specific instructions needed for organisms to develop, survive, and reproduce. Many scientists and medical professionals are excited about this breakthrough and what it could mean for developing the technology that could someday stop other genetic diseases such as cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, and several types of cancer. Today, we'll learn more about this recent breakthrough in genetic modification with a member of Dr. Mitalipov's team, as well as examine some of the ethical issues of this work. Joining me now by telephone is Dr. Paula Amato, MD. She's a member of the research team behind this recent medical breakthrough. She's also an adjunct associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology in the Oregon Health and Science University's School of Medicine. Dr. Amato, can you give us a bit of an overview of what your team actually did?
So we attempted to correct a gene mutation in a human embryo, as you say. So we recruited a gentleman who was known to carry a gene mutation in a gene called MYBPC3, and a mutation in this gene is one of the most common causes of a heart condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So his sperm carried this gene mutation. He had one normal copy of the gene and one abnormal copy. And then we recruited some young, healthy egg donors who underwent ovarian stimulation and egg retrieval, very much like we would do for a woman undergoing in vitro fertilization for infertility treatment purposes. And then we fertilized those eggs with this man's sperm. And at the same time, we introduced CRISPR. And CRISPR is a gene editing tool. It's been described as like a molecular scissors that cuts the DNA. So we introduced the CRISPR and targeted this particular gene mutation, and then we assessed the embryos to see if the gene was corrected. And we found that in a large majority of cases, the gene mutation was in fact corrected in those embryos.
So what did you actually do to correct it using the CRISPR-Cas9 system? How is it corrected?
What the CRISPR does, it basically cuts the DNA, and then you have to correct it. So usually when people work with CRISPR, they provide an external DNA template. So if you use the Word analogy, like Word, the software program, like cut and paste. So the CRISPR does the cutting part, and then typically you provide a sequence to paste into that part of the DNA that you've just cut out. But what we found in our experiment was that the embryo refused to take the pasted sequence that we provided, and instead kind of perform like an autocorrect function and use the normal copy of the gene that came from the egg to correct the gene mutation that we had just cut out.
I've heard it referred to that basically what your team did was jumpstart the natural process of the embryo correcting the problem.
Yeah, we sort of leveraged the embryo's own DNA repair system. All our cells have some capability to repair damaged DNA. Our DNA gets damaged every day by radiation or toxins or what have you. And a lot of the time, the body is pretty good at repairing those breaks. So in this case, the break that we induced with the CRISPR scissors was repaired by the embryo's own repair mechanism.
I can understand that you probably did the work on more than one embryo. How many embryos did you wind up using?
There were several dozen embryos necessary to generate sufficient numbers to be able to draw valid scientific conclusions from our experiments.
And among those embryos, what percentage would you say proved to be successful?
72% of the embryos were corrected.
Now, the gene-carrying hereditary heart condition that your team successfully corrected, is it normally carried by either the mother or the father or both?
It can be carried by either.
But in this case, it was carried by the father.
Correct.
There's a term I've been hearing bandied about when discussing your team's work is germline engineering. What is germline engineering?
So the germline refers to basically eggs and sperm and embryos. It gets passed on to future generations. So when you think about gene therapy, often you're thinking of treating a particular patient with a condition. But in this case, we were treating the embryo, which theoretically could in future result in a baby. So when we refer to the germline, we're talking about treating or doing gene therapy on eggs and sperms and embryos.
The work conducted by your team, Dr. Amato, wasn't the first time that scientists have edited a human embryo. I'm seeing reports that Chinese scientists on three occasions did the same, but it's also been said that the results of those experiments, that CRISPR caused editing errors and that the modifications made to the DNA were not taken up by the other cells of the embryo, only some. Were the Chinese experiments considered when your team went to work?
Yes. As you say, the Chinese team did some preliminary experiments in a few human embryos. In two cases, they used abnormal embryos that would not be suitable for transfer to make a baby. And in the third case, they used immature eggs, where in our study we used mature eggs, much like you would for in vitro fertilization or IVF. The thing that we did differently was we introduced the CRISPR at the same time as we injected the sperm into the egg. And that turned out to be important in correcting or overcoming one of the problems that has been seen in previous studies called mosaicism. That's a situation where you have a mixture of cells in the embryo. Some are normal and some are abnormal. Obviously, that would not be a desirable outcome. So by injecting the CRISPR and the sperm at the same time, we were able to eliminate that mosaicism problem. And additionally, in previous studies, they had seen what we call off-target effects, and that's when the CRISPR scissors cuts in places other than the intended target or location.
So it sounds to me, Dr. Amato, that your team performed this gene editing basically as the sperm was fertilizing the egg.
Pretty much, yes.
Why do you think that your team was successful while the previous experiments apparently failed?
Well, I have to give the credit to Dr. Matalapov, who's the lead investigator on our team, and he was aware of some animal studies where this had been done, injecting the CRISPR and the sperm at the same time, and thought that that might be the key to eliminating this issue of mosaicism in humans.
You say that your team's work was a good first step in human gene editing, but that a lot more research must be conducted before it's ready for even clinical trials. How far down the road are we talking?
Probably several years. I mean, we would certainly want to reproduce our work, and we'd like to increase the efficiency, et cetera. As well, there are some barriers, at least in the United States, with moving forward with this research to the clinic. So I think in the United States, we're probably a decade or so away from this making it to the clinics.
What would be the next step, then, in this process?
So for us, we're interested in improving the efficiency. So 72% is pretty good, but we'd like to see it closer to 100%. We'd like to see if it works with other gene mutations. So far, we've just tested this one gene mutation, so we're interested in other diseases. And as well, because of the mechanism of repair, we think it would only work if there is a normal copy of the gene in the embryo. So we'd like to see what would happen if there were two abnormal copies of the gene. Could we induce the embryo to take up the external template that we provided? So these are all experiments that we have planned.
What I'm curious about, Dr. Amato, is finding out if gene editing that was conducted is totally successful. In other words, to find out if it was a total success and that it was a safe method for gene editing, you'd almost have to bring an embryo to full term to see if it had other effects on the development of the baby.
You really would. I mean, that's the ultimate test. You'd have, not only would you have to take the baby to full term, but then you would have to follow that baby throughout its lifetime and then its babies, or his or her babies, rather, because you've now introduced a modification in the germline, as we mentioned earlier. So to truly know if it's safe, you'd really have to follow these children and their children for multiple generations.
And Dr. Amato, on the heels of the announcement of your team's breakthrough came expressions of fear and ethical concern from those who say that this breakthrough is the first step that will lead to designer babies. In other words, parents can customize the different traits that their babies would have and also possibly create a new era of eugenics. What is your reaction to this criticism?
Well, I think the ethical issues are actually very important, and we thoughtfully considered those before we planned our study, and I think there should be ongoing kind of discussion and debate about them. The particular issue of designer babies, however, I think is a little far-fetched at this point because, first of all, the National Academy of Sciences, which issued a report recently, said very clearly that this technology should not be used for enhancement purposes, just for the prevention of serious diseases. But even if someone wanted to use it for enhancement, the traits that people talk about enhancing, things like intelligence or athleticism, we don't know the genes that are responsible for those traits, and it's not likely to be one gene. It's probably several genes, many genes. So even if someone wanted to do that, it would be really difficult to do. Secondly, as we've shown, the embryo doesn't accept just any gene. So if you wanted to put a better version of the gene in there, it wouldn't be so easy, at least based on our early experiments.
Also curious, Dr. Amato, other than correcting a mutated genetic disease or condition, causing the gene through editing methods such as what was used in your work, are there any possible methods or treatments, either currently being researched or down the line, that would allow harmful hereditary conditions to be corrected in the carrying parent? Is this possible?
Not in the carrying parent, usually, but there is something called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD for short. And so currently, people afflicted with these conditions can undergo in vitro fertilization and then test the embryos to see if they carry the disease. So depending on the disease, in some cases, half the embryos will be affected and half will be normal. So you can test for those gene mutations and then just choose to transfer the healthy embryos. So that's available now. In some cases, that technology is not applicable. So, for example, if somebody has two abnormal copies of a gene and the condition is what we call autosomal dominant, meaning that you only need one abnormal copy to have the disease, that person's embryos are all going to be affected. So there's nothing to select. So we think this would be potentially applicable in that situation. Secondly, especially in older women, sometimes you need several IVF cycles to get enough eggs and enough embryos to find a normal one. So we think that if you can fix the embryos, then potentially the woman would have to undergo fewer cycles in order to generate healthy embryos that would be suitable for transfer.
Dr. Amato, I know the condition that your team corrected was hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. What genetic conditions would you like to see be next on your list of projects to work on?
So some of the diseases we're interested in are things like Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis, BRCA, which is a gene that predisposes to breast cancer and ovarian cancer and is common in certain populations, such as Ashkenazi Jews, for example. About 2% of them carry this gene mutation. So we're interested in diseases that are fairly common and serious.
And finally, Dr. Amato, what kind of impact would this gene editing in correcting a problem gene or a disease or condition-causing gene, what effect would that have on future generations of the person?
That's one of the implications of this germline gene editing. Not only are you preventing the disease in the next generation, in the children of the afflicted patient or couple, but you would be preventing it in that entire family's lineage. So all the children, future children, theoretically, would be free of the genetic disease.
Dr. Paula Amato, thank you so very much for joining us today and talking about your recent breakthrough.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest in our work.
That was Dr. Paula Amato, a member of the research team that successfully edited DNA within a human embryo to eliminate a genetic disorder that can cause a potentially deadly heart condition. She is also an adjunct associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology in the Oregon Health and Science University's School of Medicine. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. We would like to know what you think of VOA's Press Conference USA and would appreciate it if you would take our brief online survey. You can find it on our Facebook page at Carol Castiel, VOA. Thank you for your help as we work to improve Press Conference USA for you. Today, we're discussing the recent breakthrough in human genetic modification that allowed scientists to correct a defective gene that could lead to a potentially deadly heart condition. We'll now take a look at some of the ethical issues of this work. My first guest in this discussion is Charles Patrick. He is Vice President for Strategic Initiatives and Communications at the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. Dr. Patrick also holds a PhD in chemical and biochemical engineering and was a research scientist at the MD Anderson Cancer Center at the University of Texas. In a recent article by David Roach in the Baptist Press, Dr. Patrick said addressing life-threatening medical conditions such as myocardial disease is certainly a laudable goal. However, he says the ends do not justify the means. Biblical truth takes precedence over science advances. Dr. Patrick, you called the kind of human gene editing experimentation, such as what led to the recent successful removal of the genetic mutation, morally wrong based on biblical truth. Now, why and what do you mean by biblical truth?
Morally wrong because life was destroyed in the process of doing the experiments. So when the fertilized embryos were created, life was created then. And they were created purposely to conduct the experiment and then were purposely destroyed thereafter.
Would you consider such work that's being done, this genetic research and experimentation, interfering with God's work or humans trying to play God?
Potentially. I'm really basing most of my morality questions and comments on the fact of destroying the embryos. But any technologies that are based on genetics does have to grapple a lot of questions, such as are we playing God and so forth.
A number of scientists and non-scientists alike are pretty excited by the news that they were able to use CRISPR-Cas9 technology to prevent a possible fatal health condition, calling it the first step toward eliminating a host of other deadly genetic diseases and conditions. Now, with the goal of lessening human suffering, why would the continued experimentation in this area be wrong?
Yeah, I think all those goals are very lofty and noble to address human disease and the human condition, but the ends do not justify the means. I mean, if we have to create and destroy life in the process, I would say that is biblically and morally wrong.
What are some of the other concerns you have about human gene editing other than destroying a life to get from one point to another? And please, I'm addressing this not only to you as a person of faith, but
sure,
as a scientist with a PhD in chemical and biochemical engineering.
There are several questions, one of which is, you know, we have to talk about, is it even morally permissible to affect the human germline? Because that person has no choice in what is being done and the future generations that will be affected by that germline manipulation also do not have a choice. And so, you know, you have to talk about, you know, your liberty as a human being and choice. In addition, who gets to decide what is a appropriate genetic manipulation? You know, are there, we have to talk about, you know, what is morally good, what is not, what is possibly beneficial to mankind and what is not. Those questions have to be grappled. And then, you know, when you do make genetic manipulations, what are you saying about the value of human life? Does someone who has a altered genome, do they have a higher value in society than somebody who does not? You know, thinking about the cult classic movie Gattaca, where you had these genetic individuals who had been manipulated and they had a higher value than those who had not.
Back to the question of trying to play God. In other words, do you see efforts by scientists in areas such as this as trying to perfect God's creation?
I think it's at least manipulating his creation or trying to control it, yes. I don't know about perfecting it, but we, you know, from a biblical standpoint, we see disease and things that affect the human condition as a result of the fall of mankind and sin entering the world. And so anything that can alleviate that in a biblical moral fashion is fine, but I don't know about perfecting what God has originally created.
If human gene editing experimentation continued over the years to the point of possible clinical use, how do you see it affecting or changing the world we live in?
I think it would change it dramatically in terms of, you know, having individuals have the ability to control certain aspects of a baby. You would then have the ability to say, well, I want to have a baby that has not only prevents a disease, but maybe I want them to have increased athletic performance or a higher IQ.
Designer babies.
Yes, designer babies. So those issues have to be addressed.
And can gene editing with the goal of improving human life ever be considered morally ethical to you? And if so, how?
If it is based on the experimentation or the creation of life and then destroyed with these embryos, I would say no. If you can design gene therapies, which do exist today, without doing those experiments, and then I think, yes, they would be morally permissible.
Dr. Patrick, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me about this.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
That was Dr. Charles Patrick, Ph.D., the Vice President for Strategic Initiatives and Communications at the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. My second guest for our discussion on the ethical issues that surround editing of human DNA is Dr. John Harris. He is the Lord David Alliance Professor of Bioethics and the Director of the Institute for Science Ethics and Innovation at the UK's University of Manchester. John, human gene editing to correct or eliminate genes that can cause potentially fatal disease or conditions, while the intentions are really good, wouldn't this be considered crossing the line into territory where humans really don't belong in? Is this proposing that humans would play God?
Well, humans have always played God, and we must thank God for the fact that we do. If playing God means leaving nature as we find it, then there would be no agriculture, no artifacts, no industry, no iron horses, no horseless carriages, and there would certainly be no medicine or medical science or nuclear science or neuroscience. So I think nobody, genuinely nobody, believes that we have to leave nature as we find it. And then the question of what constitutes playing God becomes a theological question, not a moral question.
While human gene editing is still at a relatively early stage, and we could be looking at possibly years before this could be done on a regular basis, should people representing various viewpoints on this issue get together, sit down, determine some bioethical guidelines to keep things in check?
Well, people are doing that all the time. One of the problems is, of course, that the informal groupings of people who do this have no statutory implication nor no juridical implication. So lots of people get together and like to propose guidelines, but the issue is whether those guidelines are persuasive to legislators, and nothing will change unless that is the case. The other issue, of course, is whether or not the people who do get together in the ways you suggest actually recommend doing things that in a country like yours, which has a constitution, might be unconstitutional, might deny constitutionally protected freedoms, and in my country might violate legally protected freedoms, and so on. So while it's a good thing that these issues are discussed, and as many people as possible should have their say, absolutely, determining guidelines is usually actually done by pressure groups with their own interests, either religious pressure groups or indeed pressure groups from industry or pressure groups from commerce. So one, we should always be a little bit suspicious of groups that get together, however well-meaning, to produce guidelines to impose upon the conduct of
this. Dr. Harris says this technology moves forward. Do you see this, and you seem to indicate it in your last answer, do you see this as becoming a really strong political issue more so than perhaps ethical or technical?
Well, it is a political issue, but only in the sense that, I mean, there is a very old saying, and that is that justice delayed is justice denied. And that has been used to champion people's rights to access to the courts and to effective remedies for grievances. Now, in the same way, therapy delayed is therapy denied. So those who urge a precautionary approach to new science and technology have also to consider the question of whether or not, on which side of the street, rather, that precaution lies. And it doesn't always lie in the direction of doing nothing or in objecting to new science and new technologies.
Do you see a dark side of this kind of experimentation? So might we be opening a Pandora's box with this technology?
Certainly, people always ask me, but where would you draw the line? And I think that's essentially your question. And my answer is always the same. It is, show me a good reason to draw a line, and I'm happy to draw a line with the rest of them. But we shouldn't just draw lines for the sake of it, because drawing lines is not a neutral activity. Drawing lines may deny people therapies and life-saving treatments that they would benefit from, but for the conservatism of those who wish to see lines drawn. Now, on the other hand, of course, we don't want to introduce so-called therapy. We don't want to have people peddling snake oil to the nation and possibly doing more harm than good. That is, of course, what we have things like the NIH for in the United States, or the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, to try to mediate between proposed solutions to problems and see which are safe enough to introduce into human beings and which are not.
Again, we are at an early stage of the technology, the research. What particular benchmarks do you think must be met before this technology is allowed to actually be put into regular practice?
It's very difficult to set benchmarks. There's a very interesting technology which you and I have benefited from, and that is sexual reproduction. But sexual reproduction is a terribly dangerous activity. It has a 9% disaster rate in terms of transmission of genetic diseases. It has a very high failure rate. Lots of pregnancies never go to birth and so forth. If sexual reproduction had been invented as a biotechnology rather than found as a sort of evolutionary product, it probably never would have received a license. Every year, about 9 million people globally are born suffering with genetic defects, and this technology may help some of those 9 million to lead better, safer, and more productive and happy lives. So all of these questions are cut both ways. They're not simply neutral questions. Should we err on the safe side? As I say, if you take sexual reproduction as a benchmark for what we should do to future children, how we should produce them, then it's a very unsafe benchmark.
And finally, Dr. Harris, if human gene editing experimentation continued and became reasonably safe and effective to the point where it is ready for regular clinical use, how do you see it affecting or changing the world we live in?
Well, here a whole range of other issues arise. And one of those, of course, is the fair, just, and equitable distribution of the benefits of new technologies. So one of the issues that immediately arises is whether or not this will be accessible to the citizens of rich countries like yours and mine, or whether they will be made more universally or equitably available. That is the first and very important ethical issue, and it's much more actually important and much more difficult to solve than the issue of when a new technology or a new therapy is safe enough to use in humans.
Dr. Harris, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us concerning bioethics over gene editing.
It's been my pleasure.
That was Dr. John Harris, Lord David Alliance Professor of Bioethics and the Director of the Institute for Science Ethics and Innovation at the UK's University of Manchester. And that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. Thanks so much for listening. I'd also like to thank all our guests for joining us today. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Yeah.